Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 283 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, Roopa Faruqi speaks with Jane Draycott about writing of deception within families, the monster hiding in us all, embellishing the story of her father's astonishing and wayward life, and the importance of diverse characters in writing for young people.
British novelist Roopa Faruqi was born in Lahore, Pakistan, and was brought up in London. She is the author of 6 critically acclaimed novels and has been shortlisted for the Orange Award for New Writers and the Muslim Writers Award, longlisted twice for the Orange Prize and for the DSC South Asian Literature Prize, as well as the Impact Dublin Literary Award. She's the recipient for her multicultural fiction of the John C. Lawrence Prize for writing which improves understanding between races. In 2016, her new work of diverse fiction for young people was shortlisted for the Common Word Prize for Children's Fiction. I met with Roopa in Canterbury's Beanie House of Art and Knowledge, a beautiful library and gallery and museum created in the heart of Kent, where Roopa lives with her husband and family. Roopa, there's really a very searching focus in much of your work on family.
Yes.
On home, relationships between children and their parents.
Absolutely. I think that the family has always been a huge area of inspiration for me. And it started as a thread, really, through my early novels, where if I was asked to think about what my book was about, it took me a while, and I thought I would have to say it is about the impact of deception on family relationships. And it's quite hard as a beginning writer to think, what is your idée directrice? What is actually taking you through this book when you're writing with a multicast and you're trying to put in lots of interesting observations and comedy and plot and character? What is this overlying theme and something that is actually drawing you through? And I realised it was about family, and particularly deception in family, because I thought it was something that was intimate. I felt it was something I could write about that was very personal, but also something universal, because I felt that every family, whether they came from the Punjab or somewhere else, they could actually understand what it meant to have family that was perhaps hiding the truth in some way in order to keep some sense of harmony. And then that followed on into my later books, which I guess in some ways followed the thread of my life once I became a parent, to actually start thinking about parent-child relationships. So if in my early books I was talking about the intergenerational fictions that we tell each other, in my second book, I was thinking about that symbiotic relationship between the parent and the child. And that was really interesting to me, because it was not simply about the kind of child you produce is due to the kind of person you are, because we tend to blame the parents too, to quote Larkin, but also the kind of parent you are is very much dependent on the type of child you have. And in my second and my third books, I had some quite difficult children, and they created different types of parents as well. So there was a sort of feedback. And then as I carried on, I think I got a bit more ambitious and my families became ever more convoluted, dysfunctional and difficult. But it was something that I thought, like I said, that people could understand and empathise with. And I think that I was trying not just to tell a personal story, but to try and perhaps, if I was being ambitious, encapsulate our stories. So the stories of the other, and also the stories that we feel individually as we kind of struggle through our family relations and try and bind this in with everything else that makes us up.
So in a sense, the family is in some way a kind of arena for the discussion of all those psychological relationships between us. I mean, you have an extraordinary and strangely moving character in the mother, in The Good Children, a fierce mother who is also two mothers. And I just wonder whether you think that perhaps all of us have these two possibilities of who we are, the one we feel we are, and then the one we might be in different scenarios.
I think that's a really interesting thing to explore, because when I was writing that character, and I'm glad you say that you thought it was a sensitive exploration, because Other reviewers have perhaps described her as a wicked witch at the heart of a fairy tale, and perhaps in more black and white terms. And I think that probably wasn't helped that the children's perspective of her, as described in the early parts of that novel, which is from a child's perspective, was in black and white terms. That we had this mother who was good and kind and beautiful and wonderful, and we had this dark monster. And I think that I was trying to explore that there is an element in all of us of the person who, you know, we wish to be. So the mother is maternal and she is wanting the best for her children. And in many ways, she is a quintessential mother of her time. And equally, the children also viewed her in many ways as monstrous. And it's fair to say that actually my inspiration for writing her was when I actually came across a copy of Beowulf in the library. I'm not sure if it was this library. It might have been the one in a nearby town. And I thought, who creates monsters? And I thought, perhaps monstrous mothers can create monstrous children. And I thought about the responsibility involved in that. And the nameless mother in Beowulf, I thought, was incredibly touching in how she is in many ways written out of this story. And so I think I was searching for that part of all of us. And it came to light, actually, very clearly one day when I was in my kind of typical wussy liberal mother type of way telling my child to do his homework. And I think, or maybe play piano. And I think it was just for 10 minutes. I said, oh, just do it for 10 minutes. And then he had a caprice because I speak French at home. He had a little bit of a tantrum and I told him, just go and do it. And he said, oh, you're just a monster, mummy. And that was a moment when I thought, oh, maybe I am. Maybe we have this potential. And it tied in with a lot of reading I'd been doing about the Milgram experiments and about the monster within us all, about how, given the right circumstances, we can all be quite terrible people. That those particular experiments were about obedience to authority, how we can actually do quite terrible things to another person if someone else will take that responsibility for us. So that was something I wanted to explore. And I guess when I was writing about this mother, I was trying to perhaps bring together all these very complex feelings that we might have about ourselves, the darker side and the light.
It's a tremendously complex novel. It's a tremendously ambitious novel. But actually the door which we, the reader, opens on that novel is into a world which is not fictional in terms mm-hmm. of its setting. And it just struck me that was a very bold thing to do. Do you have a sense that this is something that you might do more of? You've taken something very identifiably historical, a particular moment, world famous, and placed it right there at the front. I'm assuming that the narrator who we encounter there for the first time, Sully, is fictional.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, there's a bit of historical theft, really, in taking that on. And it was a bold experiment, I think, to actually think that I had the right to take the Milgram experiment and put it in my fiction. But I thought what I was trying to do was set the tone for my novel and also for that theme, this greater theme about obedience to authority and how we learn eventually to say no rather than yes when it matters. And that was something I put right up in the front of my novel where the brother, Jakey Sadek, says, it suits you when you say no. We don't say it often enough. It's a powerful little word. And it's about being the sort of person who is willing to stand up for what is right. And for me, the experiments, they completely encapsulated that. And particularly the idea of being in a controlled situation with a controlling person, with a figure of authority, that perfectly set the scene for the family life that I was beginning to open up. And also how people eventually unlearn what they are taught about having to be good children, to do what they're told. It's another little piece of doggerel verse I wrote for the start papers for that book, which is, we sit in the dark, we sit in the cold, we're obedient kids, we do what we're told. It's good to be good, so we do what we're told. And I thought that set it up. But it was also, I guess, perhaps a little bit of a brave move, shall we put it kindly. My editor didn't think well of it. I had written a much longer piece, which actually fully encapsulated the experiment. And I was asked politely, and eventually I thought, okay, I understood why, to actually cut it right back, because they felt it was delaying us going into the story to have this set up. And so I understood that as well, but I think it was an authorial choice to open with that, and I think it wouldn't have been quite right if I had just simply stepped straight into the family in Pakistan. And also, later on, we learn how Sully has got there. And I think that's quite important as well, because these are people who have run away for this very reason. And participating in that experiment opens up all sorts of things in his past. It opens doors that perhaps he would rather have kept shut. And I think that's quite an important thing for the character as well.
Absolutely. And it just struck me that it pitched the whole novel in terms of talking about issues which were beyond the fictional lives of this fictional family.
Yes, I mean, thank you. I think that I was ambitious with this book. I did want to set it up to be a serious book. Perhaps that's not the wisest thing when you're with a publisher who actually would like to sell some copies as well. Perhaps it doesn't bring it forward as being a comedy or being a sort of lighter read.
But it's very page-turning. There's a beautiful moment where the mother looks at a jewelled box that's just she's placed mm-hmm. beside her. And the cat is playing with it, Snow White the cat, sort of zoomed right down from that large world-famous experiment only two pages before. Is that anything you were aware of doing, that kind of binary attack to it all?
I think I was, and I was aware that I was writing in quite forensic detail, so almost everything had to be important and relevant. Even quite minor details, the cat playing with the box, the crushed rose petal that's left under the foot. And when the mother sees the husband come in, somehow it implies that he'd been doing something she wouldn't believe was respectable because he'd taken his children to play. All these sort of little moments, they sort of added up and I guess created a certain, with regard to the mother, a certain sinister sense of the detail around her. And even when she was saying what might be kind things, come stay at home, we'll play, we'll have fun. It was set in such a way that the girls look with distress at their brothers to say, please rescue us, because this beautiful home she's created is a gilded cage and it feels like a trap for those girls. So all these little details, I think, while I was trying to build up layer by layer, it got to a stage where I found it quite hard to leave any detail unwritten, actually. And I had to kind of cut back. It was already quite a long book, and I had to cut back quite dramatically because I was aware that what I was doing was perhaps indulging myself a bit too much in the symbolism around the characters and then not letting the characters also talk and breathe. So I had to try and create a balance. But yes, I was very aware of what I was doing. And I think for the most part, it was effective. And thank you for saying that you thought that particular image was. In other times, I thought perhaps that image is for me, and perhaps I will just tell it a little bit more straight as well, because I could have kept on writing these scenes and these moments.
So, Rupa, in your 2012 book, The Flying Man, you write about a character called Makil, a man who doesn't want to be tied down and who moves around the world until his past catches up with him. You've said that your father was the inspiration behind this novel, that in a way you wrote it for him. You've described what you call his astonishing and wayward life as the foundation for that story. How important was it to get certain things right in that, in terms of your responsibility to what we might call the truth, or your experience of your father? At what point in that all that does or did the imagination take over, the imaginative, inventive process take over?
I made quite a determined decision when I was writing The Flying Man that it would be my story as well, rather than a ventriloquism of the story my father might have told. And I think to write that book, I had to wait quite a time after my father had passed away. It was perhaps 10 years since I found the blank CD in his briefcase. He told me he'd actually written his life story, and it was on a CD, and it was back at the hotel. He told me this just a couple of weeks before he passed away in a bar in Paris. And a couple of weeks later, he passed away in a hotel, and my sister and I went to repatriate the body to Pakistan, and that CD was blank. And I realised then that he was a man who told many tales, and him having told me he'd written his autobiography was yet another one. And I thought, the one thing my father would appreciate is a good story and the embellishment of a good story. And I felt completely vindicated in writing what I thought would be the best story I could. And I felt that, yes, his wayward life, his character, his personality, his freedom of spirit, which I always admired in some ways, even when it really annoyed me when I was a child, those were the things I wanted to capture. But he was never one to be tied down by facts, and I thought I wouldn't be either. And I thought at a certain point, the integrity of his story had to give way to the integrity of my story. My fiction had to have that polish and power, which sometimes real life just doesn't. And so even though, yes, he was a foundation for the story, I certainly wouldn't have written it without him. And in many ways, I consider that book my inheritance from him, because God knows I didn't get anything else. I think that what I did there was actually allow myself to break free from the moorings of the man who inspired this tale and let the ship run free. And I think he, of all people, would have actually really appreciated it.
That's absolutely fascinating. Over the 6 novels, published within 7 years, am I right?
Maybe 8 years, possibly, yeah.
I'm just wondering if it's possible for you to look back across them and see any trajectory, any kind of growing, developing interest or sort of direction of ideas or responses to the way the world has changed in that time?
Yes, absolutely. I think in terms of trajectory, each book grew from the last. And I tend to have my ideas for the next book I'm writing some way, maybe 2/3 through writing the last one. And I think about the ideas that are happening in the world around me, the ideas that I'm having that somehow will not fit into this current work that I'm writing, but will find a place in the new work. And I guess I am quite a responsive writer. I do write, it's wrapped in fiction, but I do very much use my own observations and emotional response to events, even if it isn't based on my own actual experience. And when things are happening around me, even, for example, I described my second book talking about the relationship between parent and child. I was a mother, I had a child. I could see, once I had another child, I could see the antagonism between two children, how you can't actually ever expect a toddler not to despise his baby brother because this person has taken over their world. And these are all things, these are real experiences, but I write them into this fictional character who actually bears quite often very little resemblance to me. But I think under the skin, we are all quite similar in some ways. In terms of response to world events, I think that was something I had to grow in confidence with in my writing. I didn't do it very much at first, but I think in my first 3 novels, I kept very close and tight to that family structure. And in a way, the family was a protecting microcosm. I could have transplanted them anywhere and told a similar story, as long as there was a sense of otherness and in terms of those kind of difficult, flawed family relationships. As I moved on, I think in my 4th novel and my 5th, I started looking at what had happened in the world of my parents' generation. So, for example, in my 4th novel, I talk about the issues between Bangladesh and Pakistan post-partition, which is something quite close to me because my mother was from Bangladesh and my father from Pakistan. And they were married at a time when those countries were at war. And there was a very difficult, bloody battle of independence. And so I write about 2 friends who were friends at Oxford in that 4th novel, Half-Life, who were eventually separated into different countries, even though they're originally from the same place. And there's one of them who is a poet, speaks very movingly to his oldest friend. And he says, "My brother, my enemy, it's time to stop fighting and go home, because it is time to leave that place that to leave his country and find another." And he says he will always find a place for this other person in his heart, but perhaps his country is somewhere different. So I started to feel brave enough to talk about those things, and they're very much the issues of my parents' generation. And by the time I got to my later novels, I felt I could do that with more confidence and perhaps feel less like someone who was just having a go at telling a story. I remember that my editor asked me about a few more details, for example, about independence, about partition. I make a point of partition in the early chapters of The Good Life. And she asked me to speak a little more about it. And I said, actually, what I don't want to do in this book is give a history lesson. It's about this family experiencing partition in their living room, on their sofa, in their private world. And if you don't understand the bigger ramifications of what it meant for the subcontinent, that's not my job to tell you, and it's not your job to actually know. I'm just trying to tell this story and to try and pass on these characters and what they're going through. So that's what I was trying to do.
Yes, you do that very delicately. In Sully, in at the beginning, is narrating his recollection of his childhood, which he, and he says, going back to 1940s Lahore, the Punjab, India, a place which no longer exists. I found that very touching, partly as a characterisation of Sully himself,
yeah.
The quiet way in which he has understood that. So you've been writing for children also recently.
The reason for it is it always slightly bothered me that we'd go to a library or we'd go to a bookshop and my children would see my books on the shelf and they couldn't really pick them out and read them. They're quite young and my books are quite dark and difficult, and even some early pages or early chapters were too hard for them. And when I published my sixth novel, I was due to start my medical training, and I thought my big ambition now actually isn't to write another piece of literary fiction, because I felt that I'd so far done what I could with the talent that I had and the experiences I had in that area. I thought, wouldn't it be wonderful if I could actually finally write something my children would read and enjoy? So during my 4 years in medical school, that was the ambition I set myself, to try and write for children. And I didn't take it lightly as a task, because I know what a terrible, terribly difficult market it is, how much I admired the writers who informed my childhood, and in many ways, I think it's the hardest task I could have set myself as a writer, considering how much I adore the Tolkiens and the Lewises and all those books I read when I was young myself. So what I started to do was write for my children's age, or a little bit older. And I was very fortunate in that one of my early drafts actually did get shortlisted for that prize that you kindly mentioned. And I carried on with that book, and I actually wrote an embarrassing amount of words against it. I actually wrote a trilogy of 100,000 words each. So there's 300,000 words of that book somewhere. But unfortunately, I didn't manage to get that one published, mainly because there were issues with the themes that I chose. And I had an underlying Greco-Roman mythology theme, which is already very much taken up in the market by better known writers than I. So, and I wasn't quite willing to change it. So I put that one to the side for now, even though I think that writing it was a great thing to do. My children did actually love it. I read it to them and they adored it. And also it was apprenticeship. And so now I'm writing something different, and I'm actually working with the Oxford University Press on a series, a middle grade series, that is very much pushing the things that I love, which is producing diverse characters as protagonists in a modern setting. And I feel that it's an area in children's publishing that is neglected, at least on the shelves. It's very hard to find books with characters who are diverse or who are other. And it's something that always bothered me when I was a child, and it bothers me still. And you'd think that 20 years on, we might have moved on. So I thought, in quoting someone much cleverer than me, if you want to be the change you want to see, it was perfect for me to try and do that. And it's actually quite fun to write as well, because in this series I'm writing, I'm only writing the first book at the moment, I have a kind of a medical theme going underneath it as well. So I've got diverse characters who are quite aspirational, who are fierce and intelligent, and who will also have this kind of underlying medical knowledge as well to try and crack medical mysteries. So I'm really enjoying the writing of that.
That's fascinating. That was going to be my next question, as to whether or not your new medical training, now that you've qualified as a doctor, is creeping into your work. The answer seems to be yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And in a way that I'm really enjoying. When I first started my medical training, I think one of my agents thought it was just a very long research project into writing a medical-based book, which is interesting, but not really what I had planned. And actually, the more I work in hospitals, I realise, you know, what a privilege it is to work closely with patients and colleagues. And I just would feel, it wouldn't feel right, actually, to try and wrap their stories in fiction, to tell their stories. I know that other writers have done it very well and to great effect, but I just, for my own integrity, I would find it very hard.
Thank you, Rupa. That was really fascinating. Thank you for being so generous in your answers.
That was Rupa Faruqi in conversation with Jane Draycott. You can find out more about Rupa on her website at www.rupafaruqi.com. That's Rupa and Faruqi spelled with two O's. And that concludes episode 283, which was recorded and produced by Jane Draycott. Coming up in episode 284, Tim Peers explores the double bind faced by authors who teach creative writing, and Andrew Cowan examines the 50-year history of creative writing courses in UK universities. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.